few months.
But we shall continue to discuss. And there are obviously many ways to emancipate. Assimilation is one way of emancipation. But please don't confuse the two things, emancipation and assimilation. And second of all, I've been told there seems to be some difficulty with the categorical imperative. Let me dispose that very quickly too. The categorical imperative is simply the distilled ideal of the Enlightenment, that namely within you, within every person, there is the faculty of rational judgment. And the faculty of rational judgment is a faculty of rational self-determination. And that faculty means that no man must be an instrument of another man, every man is autonomous, and that every man must live the kind of, and can live, the kind of rational, autonomous existence which is an example for all other men. That is what the categorical imperative means. The term categorical imperative is no longer familiar to you, for it is a construction of Latin grammar, which would be familiar to every cultured person to the 20th century, but is unfortunately no longer familiar to you. That's where the term comes from. Some of you, excuse me. It's familiar to the more cultured of you, and not so familiar to those who are not. It is, however, a Latin construction. All right. Now, I'll open it up then to any questions you may. Yes. You better speak loud, because the acoustics aren't always cracked up.
Well, the last couple weeks, you've been
lecturing
on what's been going on, all the ideas that have been flourishing.
Yeah.
Now, what's going on in the Eastern and fallen structure?
Yeah. Now, I have divorced Eastern from Western Europe for a very good idea, because historically they were. We have a whole unit in there on Eastern Europe. In Eastern Europe, the ghetto was slowly disintegrated. And slowly, but very slowly, Western ideas, the ideas that I have discussed, were disintegrating the ghetto. But at the same time, very slowly, but with a snowballing effect, there was emigration, constant flow of emigration, with a snowballing effect from Eastern Europe to the West. And Eastern Europe was still the ghetto, the Pale. It was, remember, ruled by Russia, except for Galicia, and I did deal with Galicia. Galicia came under the tolerance edicts of Joseph II. It might help all of you if you looked at the map occasionally. By the way, I just say that because I have a feeling that you are very hasty where Galicia is, which is too bad. Yes?
Well, that mentioned that Jews were placed in a funny predicament during the wars. I think that Jews were in a... They didn't know where to align themselves during the 17th century in the wars of Europe, and therefore there was a mass immigration of Jews to Eastern Europe. Now, did the Jews of Eastern Europe coming to the West have an alignment?
By and large, we shall deal with that. The immigration from the ghetto to the West affected two classes of Jews. One's the one who had read the Enlightened literature in the ghetto against great opposition, and who came to the West in order to assimilate, who gladly therefore took military service and all the things that I have told you about. But together with this, there was an increasing immigration to the West, which was simply on economic conditions. That is to say, because economic conditions, we'll see, in the East were really subsistence economics at best. The West was also the economically promised land. And the more the immigration went on, the more Jews from the East came to the West, who tended to recreate in the western city, the eastern ghettos they had left. For them, military service was a problem, but not really a problem, because when they got citizenship eventually, of course they had to serve. Most of them, and this is why I went into the emancipation in Prussia, as you may remember, never got citizenship. Therefore, these Jews were the first to be imprisoned or deported whenever there were political disturbances, because they formed a large, what later will be called, stateless element within the western cities. So it's double, really. Yes?
Two questions. One, under Joseph II, we had toleration.
Yes.
The third, fourth point was that if they were the Jews raised in a elementary school, a German elementary school, he would automatically have permission to marry.
Yes.
Your interpretation of this was an exclusive one rather than an exceptional one. I was wondering, does this mean that you must do this to get through?
Yes.
Or
yes.
Well, in other words, you couldn't get through another. So
right.
Exclusionary.
Okay. Yes. Jews were forced to go to elementary schools with a German curriculum. This was a very serious matter because the Austrian Empire was a multinational empire. So Joseph II used the opportunity to further the Germanic part of the Austrian Empire, because that applied to Jews whether they lived, let us to say, in the Czech part or in the Hungarian part, for that matter. They had to go to a German elementary school. This would have very great consequences. For eventually the Jews would be the pioneers of German culture in Eastern Europe. And the way the Jews became the carriers of German culture in Eastern Europe was largely through that route. Regardless where they lived in the Austrian Empire, they at any rate had a German education and a German curriculum, which many others didn't have. Yes?
And secondly, particularly the Middle Ages, what I understood, the concept of it was that any money lending for a profit, any getting back in return, was usury, you know?
No, not any. That goes by percentages, and I don't want to bore you with that. That's not any, not any. That goes by percentages. But by and large, the Jews had to take a higher percentage than the usual permitted one. This was because they were outside the general banking system. In other words, for an ordinary loan, you would go to a bank, but for what you call an emergency loan, you would go to Jews. So Jewish percentages, by and large, were higher than the ordinary percentages which, under scholasticism and other ideas that I won't bore you with, are permitted. Yes? Yes? Well, it was made available in state schools. Together with that, you had to have the founding of state schools in all ghetto areas. That founding of state schools took place in all ghetto areas against great opposition, sometimes riot conditions. But it did take place together with the institution to which we'll come later of the so-called government rabbi. Yes. Yes. Because this was forced from above, you mustn't forget. This was forced on from above. Yes, the school question will be in the ghetto areas an extremely important question. Don't you? Yes. In England, they had been readmitted, and their position on the whole was much the same as everywhere else in the West, except that England did not get a great emigration from Eastern Europe as soon, because of its geographical position, as soon as the rest of Western Europe got it. But they had been readmitted, as you know, under Oliver Cromwell, and by and large, Jewish society in England was like Jewish society all over Western Europe. That is to say, the descendants of officially admitted Jews, which meant a wealthy Jewish society. Until the immigration, perhaps I'd better say this, until the immigration from Eastern Europe you do not get, that means until the 1820s or so, you do not get in most of Western Europe, in all of Western Europe, a Jewish poverty. Because all these people, some of you asked about it, like Moses Mendelssohn and the others, were descended from court Jews, that is, Jews who had gotten permission since the 17th and 18th century to settle outside the ghetto because they were useful to the court and to the monarchy. That meant they were bankers by and large. They were bankers, traders at times, but mostly bankers. Jewish society in the West was a wealthy society, and you don't get anything approaching Jewish masses or Jewish poverty until you get the emigration in the 19th century, not really till the 1820s and later, of Jews from Eastern Europe, who then go into marginal economic activity, and who begin to be, if you like, a Jewish proletariat in the West. That is unknown in the period we are talking about. There is no Jewish proletariat. You may wonder why there are so many. Well, when a court Jew got a patent to settle, and this was by royal patent or privilege, usually his relatives also got a patent and privilege. That is how the Western Jewish community were established. First, they were the relatives of the court Jews, and then it began to branch out after that, so that it was, on the whole, a very wealthy society, upper middle class in state, decidedly upper middle class in state. And the poor Jewish masses don't really begin to be meaningful until the mid-19th century. Not really completely meaningful until the end of the 19th century. Jewish poverty, Jewish proletariat in the West did not really exist, I would say, in any quantity in Paris, Berlin, or anywhere else until the 1880s, 1870s, 1880s, when you have the accelerated emigration from Eastern Europe. Otherwise, you must remember this place in a very wealthy circle. Very. Yeah?
I get a Jew getting enough influence or power to become a court Jew.
You mean in the early period? Well, that could be done in several ways. It could be done by financial skill. The monarchs had to borrow, after all, by financial skill. There were many of them who got wealthy enough in the 17th century in the ghetto itself, because there were ghettos all over the West, wealthy enough in the ghetto itself to make the jump, because the government started to borrow from him. For example, the House of Rothschild is a good example, started to borrow from him. And the next step for such wealthy people is to get a patent or privilege to settle where no Jews had settled, which was usually the capital of the country. On the whole, Jews were never allowed to settle in the capital, by and large. In the capital, Paris is an exception. In the capital, London is later exception, but Berlin is not in the capital. And it comes about in this particular way. Through wealth, through influence, at court, you know, that way. Yeah?
I don't understand your use of the idea of a categorical imperative as part of the romantic critique of Judaism. I see that as part of the Enlightenment critique.
Yeah.
And no, as such, I see it completely answered by Mendelssohn.
Yeah, that's right. No, it doesn't reappear in Romanticism. I didn't want to give you that impression. No. In Romanticism, something remains. But the point is, in Romanticism, for the categorical imperative, the soul and emotions are in a way substituted, I suppose you might say. But for Jews, in spite of the Romantic movement, the categorical imperative will remain important when it's no longer important for all of the rest of the population. That's all the point I wanted to make, that eventually the Jews will be 60 years behind time, perhaps even 100 years behind time. By the 1930s, they're probably 100 years behind time in Europe. because the categorical imperative was still alive in Jewish society, when in Gentile society, romanticism, the new nationalism, all of that had long ago triumphed. But among Jews, the categorical imperative was still alive. Yes. I didn't mean to say that it continued only among Jewish circles and only among certain Jewish circles. You will see next week others in which it did not continue. But if it did not continue, it usually led to baptism, as you will see next week when we come to baptism. Yes.
The new Orthodox conservatives, I know, that first believed that Israel was a religious idea, just an idea.
Yeah.
Before we change your state.
Yeah.
Now, what are we supposed to do with this idea? I mean, are we supposed to change your state to this ideal, or are we supposed to keep it and basically forget about it?
No. On the contrary, there is a mission of Judaism, which I said. That idea, Israel is an idea. Israel is the idea of ethical monotheism. You know, ethical belief in one God. This again connects to the categorical imperative of all of this. Israel is the rational religion, if you like, in a way. And therefore your duty is, as a believer, in this rational ideal, in the ideal of ethical monotheism, to do your best to transform the state in which you live, I mean the nation state, in which you live, towards an ethical state. So the state that corresponds to what they call Jewish ethics, which were really, in this sense, the ethics of the Enlightenment, if you see what I mean. Ethical monotheism. Yes?
Along the same lines, I understood this mission as a twofold mission. One was to lead a Jewish life itself, and two, was to spread this ethical monotheism.
Yeah.
Was there any missionary activity? If not, why not?
No.
And,
missionary activity in Jews is a very difficult subject. But by and large, with emancipation, missionary activity was rejected because it was, of course, one of the Christian accusations against the Jews. Of missionary activity. This is endured very strong, because the condemnation of Judaism to have missionary activity on part of Judaism was, of course, to extend the evil. So that by and large, all Jewish reform, at any rate, obviously rejected the missionary activity.
But it doesn't follow. If you're dealing with the spreading of an ethical good, something which is reasonable, it would be reasonable then to go out and try to convert people or spread idea.
You are an example. No, that wasn't reasonable to them. Because you are an idea. You are the example of ethical monotheism. And if they had missionary ideas, they would have come into another problem. Namely, this is why Jews have to be Jews in order to be examples of this ethical idea. In order to be examples. Now, they never really went into why they don't missionarize in this sense, but it was constantly affirmed that Judaism has never been a missionary religion. This was another part of, if you like, assimilation, another part of keeping Jews separately, really, of keeping them separately with something with ethical monotheism. And if you discard the ceremonial law, it's not easy to do.
That then cuts down the options the concrete options of spreading this ethical monotheism. What other means were open?
What the rabbis in Reform, or all over the West, because if we talk of Reform, we're talking about Western Judaism, period. What they all did, they exhorted you to go into politics. To adopt it into active citizens. That was the role. Active citizens, as I illustrate. That is what you would be exhorted to do. Active citizenship, of one way or another. Ethical dealing, personally, that, of course, when we come to anti-Semitism, is very important. because what you must not forget, and I'm separating it here for our purposes, but it was never really separated, is that all this is written on the basis of various anti-Semitic waves to which we shall come. That you must not forget, which are very similar because they all have the similar accusation, but with, in a way, if you like, increasingly rapid anti-Semitic waves, which came increasingly frequently, starting with the first big one, started by students. They were mostly started by students, to come to that. In 1819, the student anti-Jewish riots in 1819, which went on and on and on, and you mustn't forget that. Therefore, again, you couldn't miss it. Yeah.
Seemingly opposite trends of light and orthodoxy.
Yeah.
Do you think it's plausible to see the terms of like the Jewish identity, or is this so much in flux now that we really can't discuss the different terms?
But that's what we're discussing.
Well, I know, well, and whether you include on it or can you include anything on it?
I mean, this reform was a matter of Jewish identity. We shall come into it a little more when we come to the problem of baptism next week. Yes, this was a new kind of identity, if you like, which already leads us to a Jewish identity that is divorced from religion. After all, and perhaps I should have made that clearer, the main problem of identity of any group is always how to maintain it if you get rid of its traditional basis. So the problem was, how can you maintain Jewish identity and get rid of the traditional basis, which you know from Katz, religion. I mean, you know, a very explicit ceremonial religion with all the commandments, with a theocracy, really a kind of theocratic identity. And now you're getting rid of the traditional basic identity, then you are in trouble. You mustn't forget something else too, which some of you read back much too far. As you will see, ideas of race are not yet on the horizon. They're much too early yet. Ideas of race don't become important till the 80s and 90s. You have to have developments of anthropology, which are not yet on the horizon. So race is not yet a problem, or does not yet exist. So the problem is always, you can think of it this way, to answer your question, if you get rid of the traditional base of identity, what identity is there left? Right?
Yes.
Well, I'll be telling you what identity, first of all, Moses Mendelssohn, who still stands at the crossroads, wanted to keep. And now you have the identity of reform. The identity of reform is, I suppose, the mission of Judaism. That is the identity. And the identity of a religious service. Of a religious service. But a religious service, which still has many Jewish elements, don't forget, as we'll come later on to the erosion even of many of those, but which still has many Jewish elements, but which makes a certain adjustment to Protestantism and to Protestant service. But you still have that as well. You mustn't exaggerate, in other words, within the Protestant service, the erosion of as yet the Jewish elements. You see what I mean? Yes.
Okay, very well then. Who are in these Jewish circles in the 1920s and 30s then, who are viewing to the categorical imperative line? Are they
these people?
Are these people who confess Judaism? Are these people who are Snowalski and...
In the
1820s? In the 1930s.
Oh, well, that all has changed by then. That's the Jewish establishment then, and the intellectuals. That has changed by then. I don't want to go that far ahead. But in the 1820s and 30s, those would be exactly the kind of people I've been talking about. Abraham Geiger, Hirsch, and all of that tradition. The Jewish reform, even by the 1920s and 30s, Western Judaism was Jewish reform. I must always emphasize that. It's reform. It's reform always. Now, Orthodoxy only among the immigrants. Orthodoxy only among the immigrants. Politically unimportant, politically fringe. The center of the communities are there, a reform. Yeah. Yes, another question?
I'd like to follow this up. And then by the time we get to the end of this period, we see the Jewish community as a religious group rather than an ethnic group.
Right. Right. But that was already, as I said, implied in all of that. As I tried to illustrate, in the schools, Jewish religion was one subject among many. In other words, the permeation of life which you have, let us say now, in the ghetto, in your Katz reading. That's really one part of your Katz reading. The details aren't so important in Katz. What's important is that you get the idea of the permeation of all life with this theocracy. Judaism becomes a confession of faith in France and everywhere else, as you know, just as Protestantism and Catholicism.
Well, certainly. The only thing that comes up as a problem is putting people like Karl Marx in the
tradition. No, don't. That's highly misleading. And wait with that, because I'm going to talk next week about Marx's father a little. I'm going to use Heinrich Marx as an example. The only problem in Marx is why baptism waited until he went to school, which I'll talk about. But as for Marx and the Jewish tradition, you get outside history into a kind of ethnic idea, which is very vague. You get into that kind of thing that I want to avoid because I'm silly, that Jews have a special predilection to being doctors or lawyers. That's a social phenomenon. My son the doctor, my son the lawyer. That's not an ethnic group. So I don't want anything to do with that kind of an idea. As far as the other silly thing that you always hear, that Jews are continuing the ideas of the prophets and all that sort of stuff, that's similarly vague and meaningless. That depends on the Sunday school curriculum, and it depends how much people took to the Sunday school curriculum, not much. So that's equally vague and silly.
Yeah.
Yes, because eventually, but we should come to that, eventually, of course, we come to this problem by the end of the century in a very aggravated form. What is a Jew? You see, a question that would never have been asked during the ghetto period, and that is now coming up. I mean, religion is rejected. What are you left with? Well, that's what the course will be about eventually, you know. But I mean, I don't know. Eventually, you use kind of myths to keep a kind of cohesion. The myth of Jewish aptitude for medicine, or the myth of Jews as liberals. You see, that myth has historical basis. As I told you, why the Jews who went into politics went into liberal politics, it's quite easy, and you don't need a myth. That's quite logical. But you use a series of myths then, see? And eventually, of course, the myth of the soil. But that is of no importance as yet for the majority of Western Jews whatsoever. So eventually, you've got to hold it together somehow, you know? And some hold it together, you know, I don't know by what. You know better than I, perhaps, some of you, what it eventually comes to. But we are very far removed. We are as yet, and I must make this clear, very, very far removed from either the idea that certain food habits hold Jews together, or the idea, I don't know what the idea is in American Jewish community, that contribution to Israel is all that holds Jews together. We are far removed from that. That is a kind of reduction to an absurd minimum. Yeah?
Could you reiterate the difference between Reform and Religious Reform and Religious
Yes, they were antagonistic. That didn't mean that Geiger and Pilsen's paths were that far removed from another. Geiger gave up more of the tradition. He gave up almost everything of the tradition. The chief difference is that with Hirsch you still have a great reliance on the Bible and on biblicism. A part of course now from the ceremonial laws, but Hirsch's followers even kept a great many of the ceremonial laws. While Geiger gave up all of this, all of this, and it becomes a dynamic tradition which is constantly changing and really stresses only the prophets in a way, from the Bible. So that is the difference. That Hirsch, yet you have the keeping of certain ceremonial laws. For example, Hirsch's followers kept the dietary laws. In Hirsch, women and men worshipped separately in the synagogue. In Geiger, all this was no longer of any importance. Of any importance, really. Eventually. Yeah.
Kant had a chapter on the Hasi, whatever that is.
Yes,
big enough that I didn't really get anything out of it.
Well, to that we shall come. That's an Eastern European phenomenon, not a Western European phenomenon at all. And I would like to leave the Hasidim aside until we come to Eastern Europe. Then you will hear a great deal more about it. It is, well, to put it in one word, it's very difficult. It is a Jewish religious sect of Eastern Europe, which is, well, I don't like to say, you know, semi-mystical means nothing, really. Semi-mystical, but really it is a sect tied to what we call wonder rabbis. It is tied to certain rabbis, called by certain rabbis, but otherwise we shall talk about it at length. It is very important indeed in the whole thing. It is really, let me put it this way, an 18th century revival of Judaism, which is not parallel to the revival of Christianity in the evangelical movement and things of this nature, because the 18th century was also a time of religious revival. It is a religious revival of a peculiar sort in Judaism, and I wish you would just put it aside until we come to Eastern Europe, where it is important. In Western and Central Europe, it will not be important at all. In fact, they will know as little about it as you do. Oh, as I do. Yes. Yes.
You have been discussing this problem of Jewish identity, and for the most part, your discussion has been a treatment of an elite group, intellectuals, wealthy people, and bankers.
Yes, Western Europe, Jewish.
In this early period, the period of the early 19th century, is there any distinction, a class distinction that could be made? In other words, did the people of the middle class, lower middle class?
There was in Western Europe among the Jews no lower middle class. That doesn't exist as far
as the people in the middle class.
That hardly existed too. You see, even it's quite different. You cannot apply class ideas to Jews at this stage. For if you had middle class Jews in the West, they were related by family to upper-class Jews. It is just as, let us say, you live in a swanky part of America, yes? And let us say, let me put it this way, all Western Jews were a gigantic scarf there. But it's true in a sense. And you have poor relatives. I mean, poor relatives, all right, they moved to New Rochelle or somewhere. But they're not class separated from you. They're not class separated. Class distinctions are idiotic in most cases, anyhow. But they're more idiotic here than usual, because they're not that separated. First of all, probably you're supporting these poor relatives who slid off from the upper into the middle class. That makes all sorts of problems. So you can't say it. You only get this at the very end, and you never really get it, you know. I mean, Jewish structure, social structure in the West is abnormal, because Jewish social structure in the West will never have a laboring population or an artisan population. In the West, I'm talking, not in the East, that's totally different. in the West, we'll never have laboring population, much of an artisan population, or anything. Part of the trouble is that Jewish social structure in the West is very lopsided, and then you get underneath it the immigrants from Eastern Europe, but they won't be laboring people either, and they won't be artisans either. They will be small merchants and peddlers. Again, a very odd economic structure. So you mustn't forget that. You can't just apply class names. Yes?
Well, in terms of your analogy that you just drew, as I took it from American society and then putting it just to Western European society,
yes.
I
think but of course different than scholars.
But I think to draw that analogy,
yeah.
If people were to really look in modern-day America, like I have documented proof of many families in Chicago, which are in the lower class on welfare and all these other things.
Well, that didn't exist.
This exists in America today.
Yeah.
And your distinction between Western European and Eastern European, it's the same thing as between living in Scottsdale, still living in Brooklyn.
It becomes important in America only, and we're not concerned with that, when you take, you know, somebody wrote a book about it, the so-called American Jewish, German Jewish elite, who were just the same social structure as the people I'm talking about, the Schiffs and the Adlers and the Sulzbergers. That's the kind of people I'm talking about, that kind of social strata, because Western European Jewry was that kind of social strata. That is the point. And if there were poor Jews eventually, and there were, not till the 70s and 80s, and then their charity is taken care by others, other Jews. And it was never that numerous in the West, really. Yes? That is an exception, because as I told you, Alsace-Lorraine was the Eastern Europe of France. And Alsace-Lorraine had a large poverty-stricken Jewish population, the same as the Pale. That is to say, a Jewish population that in our period still lived in ghettos, a Jewish population that really lived as in Eastern Europe on the margin of subsistence. That is to say, an economic endeavor which was subsistence. That is usually small and very small scale commerce. Yes. No, I mean all of the West except Alsace-Lorraine. Alsace-Lorraine is very exceptional. It's very exceptional. But it determines a great deal of French policy talks too. It's like Napoleon. Germany and Central Europe, to be sure, Austria had her Galicia too. That's true. But in the rest, this would not be true. No. It would be on the borders, but not inside. Yes.
And why is Alsace-Lorraine an exception?
Because historically, the Jews were chased from Alsace-Lorraine for certain reasons I don't want to go into. They have to do with principalities, as they have been everywhere else. In other words, when the Jews were expelled from France for 100 years, they were not expelled from Alsace-Lorraine. Yes. No, but I will in a few minutes. Because in Italy we have a social problem which is very peculiar, and I'll have to go into it. Italy has a totally different structure of the Jewish community than the rest of Western Europe. Well, as you may know, in Italy Jews become generals. Sure. That doesn't happen anywhere else, including to Mussolini's chief of staff at the outbreak of the Second World War. In Italy, the Jewish structure is so relatively different that next week I can talk about Italy somewhat separately. There are historical reasons. It's quite different. Quite a different structure. Yes?
Would you be able to give me a population distribution, Jewish population distribution, as between Eastern Europe and Western Europe?
Oh, I can just give you a rough one. I would say perhaps of all the Jews in Europe, one-tenth were in the West, and 80 to 90% in the East, in the period we're dealing with.
Is this not relevant to the...
No, it isn't at the moment, because the ideas in the East came from the West, and the ideas that will make the difference in Eastern Europe came from that 10%. History has nothing to do with majority. know, very few things have anything to do with majority. Nothing at all. And the ideas that were to be important for the ghetto, we are dealing with now. And the ideas that were to be important for the founding of Zionism, we are dealing with now, all of that. Because eventually, it is the Western Jews who will become intellectually, in many ways, dominated. Partly because of their wealth, too, I'm not talking, but dominated. As I said, for Eastern Europe, we are now dealing with the promised land for many of them. Don't forget that. So, when we come to Eastern Europe, we will see these ideas. Don't forget, too, that the Eastern European Jews eventually become the pioneers of German culture. That's what made National Socialism a double tragedy for them, because they were pioneers of German culture, above all, the Eastern European Jews. So, as usually, majorities have nothing to do with anything except rights. Yes?
Yeah. Warsaw,
yes, yes, we are coming to that. There were lots of things going on in Warsaw, lots of Vilna, above all Vilna, but we're coming to that. Quite separate, quite separate. But what was going on in Vilna, you will see, comes partly as the influences from the West come into Vilna. You know? And bright young Jews began to read Moses Mendelssohn and others, and then you're in trouble.
Yeah. When you talk about German Orthodoxy of this period, you're not talking about the same Orthodoxy of today, are you?
The Neo-Orthodoxy that we're talking about is the Hebrew Union College. That's what I'm talking about. Yes. What is Neo-Orthodoxy in Germany? I'll come to that next week, because it has something to do with the science of Judaism. It eventually leads to the founding in this country of Hebrew Union College. Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati.
Hirsch is connected with the Hebrew Union College.
It is one line, yes. From Hirsch and Geiger, both of them. Through the science of Judaism to Hebrew Union College. Hebrew Union College, in fact, was founded by German Jews, as you know. So, that is what we're talking about, yes. Yeah. The thinking of the majority, first of all, we'll never know. But by and large, the majority, let us say, in Eastern Europe was Orthodox, as you know. The Hasidim had a certain influence on it, but I haven't seen any statistics on that. But what is going to change Jewish history and move Jewish history will be, as always, elites and the thought of elites and the action of elites, which will eventually move forward Jewish history. Not the thought and action of majorities. The majorities were peddling on the street of Warsaw, Orthodox, sometimes Hasidim, but even for the Hasidim, the thought wasn't set by those majorities. Surely. Especially for the Jews, this is true. Especially for the Jews, were prone to being manipulated, I would say, by elites of various sorts. And what was influences on them were not only outside, but inside elites, as we shall see, will be especially influenced there. So I don't know what you mean here by majority at all. It will always be elites. First it will be the Haskalah elite, the Hasidic elite, then it will be the Zionist elite, which is always an elite, and things like that. They have built up mass movements, this is quite true, but it's first the elite that will build up the mass movement. But, let us say, Jewish assimilation is a product of, and I'm not calling assimilation, that's, after all, if you look at Jewish history, what's the important thing? The important thing isn't Hasidism in the long run, certainly. The important thing in the long run are problems of assimilation, right? And problems of assimilation were pioneered by the people we are talking about. That's what's going to determine, and the reaction to it. And this is only 10%, but these are going to determine the reactions to assimilation. And inasmuch as for any group living in general society, assimilation is all important, I don't really care whether it's 1%, Moses Mendelssohn is only one man, you see? So masses mean very little in history. They only mean something when you want to manipulate. That's not quite true, but nearly. So, and for Jews especially, Jews are a matter of elite, more almost than anything else. Well, I think I'll better leave it here today.